If you're a pop culture junkie who loves TV, film, music, comedy, and other really important stuff, then you've come to the right place. Get ready and settle in for Classic Conversations, the best pop culture interviews in the world. That's right, we circled the globe so you don't have to. If you're ready to be the king of the water cooler, then you're ready for Classic Conversations with your host, Jeff Dwoskin.
All right, Rachel, thank you so much for that amazing introduction. You get the show going each and every week, and this week was no exception. Welcome, everybody, to episode 218 of Classic Conversations. As always, I am your host, Jeff Dwoskin. Great to have you back for another celebratory classic conversation. My guest today is Greg Cope White, screenwriter, producer, author, veteran. Greg is an amazing human being, and we're going to talk all about his memoir, The Pink Marine, an inspirational story of a teenage boy struggling with self-acceptance and doesn't fit the traditional definition of manliness, finds acceptance and self-worth in the Marine Corps boot camp at a time when being out wasn't in. Greg's story is coming up in just a few seconds. And in these few seconds, I want to recap last week's interview with Joyce Bulafont, an amazing deep dive into her memoir, so many great stories from Mary Tyler Moore, and how she was almost Carol Brady. So much greatness in that episode as well. But right now, polish your shoes, stand at attention, at ease, soldier. All right, now we can enjoy my conversation with Greg Cope White. Enjoy. All right, everyone, I'm excited to introduce you to my next guest. Screenwriter, producer, author of The Pink Marine. Welcome to the show, Sergeant Gregory Cope White.
What? Reporting as ordered, sir.
I hope you don't mind. I extended it to Gregory. I thought that sounds better than Sergeant Greg. I don't know why. It just sounded so more official, Sergeant Gregory White.
It does, but you know, I hear Gregory and I think it's my mom and I figure I'm in trouble. So.
All right. We'll go back to Greg full time. So amazing to have you on the show. Thank you for hanging with me.
I am really happy to be with you.
So I loved your book. Thank you for sending me a copy. I enjoyed it. It was easy to read. I'm not like the best reader in the world, but I thoroughly got sucked into your book. I love short chapters that are succinct, and it was funny. I tell you, when I read your book, first thing that kind of went through my mind when you went to the Marine boot camp was that scene in Anchorman where Ron Burgundy jumps into the bear den and he says, "I immediately regret this decision."
I've never had that comp. That's great. You know, those are all really lovely words to hear as a writer.
Yeah, it was really, really enjoyable. I love that whole journey and I'd like to talk through a bunch of it with you, but I'd love to kind of, what's your origin? Like, where did, I know you moved around a lot as a kid. What was the kind of impetus that got you into writing and following your passion to write?
I did live all around. I had so many collective stories and memories from moving around so much. You know, I went to 13 schools in 11 years. In the 10th grade alone, I went to 3 schools. While that can leave a lot of scars, it also has some weird benefits, and including the ability to adapt and overcome, which is sort of the Marine Corps mission. And I knew the minute I walked into boot camp, I knew that I was going to write about it. I didn't know what that looked like because I wasn't a writer yet. To me, that was something that was unattainable. I didn't have an education. I didn't know anything about Hollywood or anything like that. I always dreamed of that life. I actually, as a kid, wanted to be an actor. So when I got out of the Marine Corps, I moved to New York City and studied acting. I enrolled in school and very quickly started working. And then that led me to move to Los Angeles. And I just got really lucky. And within a couple of years, I had transitioned from acting to writing. And I just got really lucky. And I got a job working for Norman Lear.
I mean, is there anyone greater than Norman Lear? That was 704 Hauser.
No, my first show with him was The Powers That Be. It was a really funny political comedy with Holland Taylor and John Forsythe, and also a cast of Undiscovered. It was David Hyde Pierce's Discovery. He had just moved out from New York. His son was played by a 10-year-old kid. It was his first acting job. That was Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Oh, wow.
So it was a great cast. It was hilarious. That ran for two seasons. And then we moved on to 704 Houser, which was who's living in Archie Bunker's house today? And this was the 90s. And we did some research on the demographics of that neighborhood in Queens. And it was a mostly African-American neighborhood. And so we put a Black family in Archie Bunker's house. Norman had the sets in storage and he took them out and we redecorated and redecorated the themes of the show. And it was a lot of fun. That was for CBS.
I love that show. I remember that show because I love John Amos and Maura Tierney. And that was a really fun show. I don't think it lasted that long, but it was a great concept and idea.
Yeah, it was six episodes and it was a lot of fun. We had, and Maura was great. She was terrific and kind of a discovery.
Sounds like you met a lot of great people like earlier in their careers and they kind of just blew up, you know, like David Hyde Pierce. I mean, obviously Frasier. And
I've had good fortune to work with people like Norman Lear who attract that level of talent with really amazing projects.
What was it like being part of that Norman Lear ecosystem, that world where development and...
I don't know what it's like not to be in it because I'm still in it. And, you know, he's behind my show. So it is wonderful because I've always looked at Hollywood as having a big wall around it. And inside the wall is legitimate Hollywood. People with agents and managers and projects that are looked at and considered by studios. And then outside the wall are all the people trying to get in. And they all have terrific projects and great imaginations and great skill for the most part. It just is going to take that break to get them over that wall and get in that world. So once you're there, you just have to make sure not to mess it up and get kicked out of the kingdom.
What were the jobs you had along your way as you kind of, I mean, I know you're now, your new show, and we'll get to that. The Pink Marine is with Norman Lear. He's an executive producer. What were some of the early roles that you did? Like, what was your evolution before, you know, obviously right now having a show with him?
I started as an assistant in the office, and I was told when I was hired that they knew that I was a writer. And if I would just do a year without asking anybody to read a script, just put my nose down, do my work and learn. And I was happy to do that. That's paying dues. And the next day, Norman came up to my desk and said, introduced himself and said, I heard you're a writer. And I said, yes, of course. And he said, have something on my desk tomorrow. So I did. And that was the beginning of working for him in that capacity. So I still was an assistant for probably, I don't know, 9 months or a year before I wrote the episode of Powers That Be and then went on to develop things as well. We had a show in development with Sony for Margaret Cho. She had not been discovered yet and was still doing a lot of stand-up, but we lost the bidding war to her for Ted Disney. So I developed other things and wrote other things. And then I left Norman's company and went on staff on another show that was, I don't know, I wrote a Dream On episode, which was the same creators of Powers That Be, David Crane and Marta Kaufman. So I wrote one of those. And then after I was on staff, I just kept going. And then I was a writer from then on out. I also along the way did some other things. Getting ready for my blog, you know, writing scripts is a different style, obviously, than long form narrative. And it's something I didn't know. I didn't go to school. I'm not a trained writer. So I knew that I wanted to write the story. I just didn't know how to do it. So I actually started a blog, ran a blog for a couple of years. And I would write stories about the Marines and write a lot of stories about cooking. And as I was writing the book, I had two opportunities come up. I didn't take any jobs while I was writing the book. I just focused on that. But one was with Food Network and one was with Mark Burnett. So I went on a reality competition show, a cooking show for Mark Burnett. I cook all the time. And that was a lot of fun. And I did it in case that was a fun part of my book marketing platform. And then Food Network reached out and said, we'd like to talk to you about turning the character that you are on your blog into a TV show. So I shot a pilot for them and that didn't go anywhere, but they had me host some other things for them.
When I finally discovered eatgregeat.com, right now it's private. So I didn't.
It's down right now, but yeah. There's a lot of short stories on there. There's a few Huffington Post picked up the blog and there's some on there. Those are still up, but yes, it's not, that blog isn't live right now.
Yeah, I saw you had like, you were on Unique Eats and Cake Masters. And when you say you cook and you talk, are you dessert oriented? Or like, is that your, or are you just any food?
I cook
any food.
I'm any food. The first show Food Network put me on was a dessert show. And I'm not mad at that. You know, you're going to pay me to go around the country and eat desserts. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It does not sound like torture.
I'm like any other writer. I literally will work for Food Network.
That's awesome. It's amazing that every one of your passions, you've been able to kind of expand into a greater thing, like, you know, food, and then the blog, you know, became a potential Food Network show, but then also, you know, being on all the other shows, being Marine, and that blog led to a book, which is now a TV in development.
I owe all that to the Marine Corps and the things that they instill in you for success and motivate. It sounds like a cult, but look, if that's what it took to get me, who was, you know, raised with no hope, no future, not knowing where I was in the world, you know, this is out was not in. So there, I didn't see a life and a place for myself in society. I, you know, gay people were arrested when I was growing up.
All right. So let's talk about that. Let's talk about, so you're 19 years old, right? You're going to 18 years old. Your great friend, Dale, who sounds like an amazing, amazing person.
We're closer than ever. We're best friends to this day. We both live that's probably the biggest question I get about the book is what happened to Dale? Everything that we ever dreamed of came true. He's a very successful surgeon here in Southern California. I'm a godfather to his kids, and we talk or text every single day.
What made Dale so amazing that he was able to accept you at such a young age? Like, because obviously he must have been raised, you know, well, and like he accepted you and, you know, became part of your protection, not, you know, mental protection, at least when you went into the Marines. I'm fascinated by at that age, especially in the way society was at the time, you know, it's so unforgiving, like how amazing he was.
Yeah, you know, his support is the touchstone of my entire life. It's true. We've been best friends for 13. So to have his support from that early age is remarkable. We can't figure it out. He can't think of it another way. He's such a good, nice guy that he wasn't about to judge me for something that he didn't see. All he saw was a nice guy that he enjoyed being with, who was funny and got his sense of humor. He got my sense of humor. What's not to get along about that? We weren't competing for each other in any way. We weren't dating each other. We had our separate lives. So it really just was we often refer to it as a soulmate.
Hello, rest of the world. See, it's not that hard, right? We're all just here to do good and get along.
If people were to strip away more and get to the fact that there are things that you, and look, we don't have to like everybody, but I certainly don't want to be liked for the things that you don't know about me. I don't want to be not liked for the things you don't know about me. You know, call me all the names you want, because it's going to roll off my back. I've had drill instructors call me much worse than anybody else could.
Oh, yeah. It was uncomfortable even just reading that in the book. To be honest. Sorry to interrupt. Have to take a quick break. Want to thank everyone for their support of the sponsors. When you support the sponsors, you're supporting us here at Classic Conversations. And that's how we keep the lights on. And now back to my amazing conversation with Greg Cope White. We're going to dive down the path that led him to the Marines. And we're back. All right. So you don't know, you know, you're looking for your path. Being out wasn't as accepted. So you decide to go to the one place where it's the least accepted, right? In the Marines. Now, I know Dale was going. And so part of it was that going with him.
I didn't know what that meant. When he called me, he'd been to the Air Force Academy. He got an appointment to the Air Force Academy. And during that first year, his vision went just a little bit off. So he couldn't be a pilot. And he didn't want to be a navigator. He wanted to be a pilot. Dale's an achiever. So he called me. We both had our freshman year of college, or junior college in my case. And he told me that he was leaving the Air Force Academy, but he had a military commitment to fill out. And his father was a master gunnery sergeant in the Marines, which is the highest enlisted rank, and always had hoped that his son would be a Marine. So Dale continues to tell me that he's going to go away for the summer. He's going to Paris Island for a boot camp. He'll be gone all summer. And all I really heard was summer and camp. And I thought, I love camp. I'll go with you. And that's a true testament to Dale. He never said no. He never said, this is crazy. He said, you should really think about it because this is very difficult and hard. But I just thought, I'm going to go get to spend the summer at summer camp at Paris Island sounds pretty exotic with my best friend. So what could go wrong? And then as I went down through the process to begin the enlistment process, then things got, you know, a lot of red flags came up. I'd never been asked before if I were gay, but the way that the Marines asked it at the time was they stretched it out. You know, I was in the South, so we were in New Orleans, long. So that you've got this big, tough Marine Corps drill instructor, or a recruiter sitting across from you, asking you 9 ways to Sunday if you're a homosexual. I didn't know that question was coming. I had never been asked that before. I wasn't ready for it. And I somehow got through and I lied. I lied then. I lied 9 different times. And then somehow convinced him. He signed off on the paper, but I still had to take a physical. And I was 14 pounds shy. So you'll read in the book about what I did to get through it. But if since you've read the book, that's the Charles Chips can that we filled up all those years ago with snacks to eat. His mother kept everything. And she was fantastic. She's in the book and the show.
Yeah, you worked really hard to meet those requirements. It must have been so hard. I mean, just it's like when I'm reading it, you know, it's one of those things where like, you know, I know, you know, don't ask, don't tell, you know, all those things like, you know, but reading your book kind of brought it much closer to me to understanding what all this meant. And it just, to me, like, it's crazy, like, just to think how it's one thing for them to be anti-gay. I mean, not, you know, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? It's like one thing for them to think it, but like for them to like put it into like the questionnaires, like they like to be so outward, like to make sure that they're weeding it all out at the source. It was just, that caught me a little off guard while I was reading it. I didn't realize it was so blatant, like that level, like we don't even want you in the door. We're going to do everything we can to keep you out right from the get-go.
Yeah, because as you'll know from the inciting incident of me even getting in, I didn't fully understand what I was doing. And like you just said, to compare that to Anchorman, had I known what was about to come, I would have never done it. Absolutely not. So I'm actually happy that I wasn't raised on war movies and playing G.I. Joe and all that, because I came in as a completely blank slate. Look, let's be honest. I have to admit that this place that was completely prescriptive to my lifestyle turned out to give me the confidence to even come out while I was in the Marine Corps in private, not to them. They gave me the confidence to live my authentic life that they hated.
Well, it was good that you served up lemons. You made lemonade and were able to make that so positive.
Pink lemonade.
Thank you. How did I miss that, Avi?
Hey, writing teams are the best. I love my writing partner, Sean Dwyer. We write a lot of things. Both our Netflix movies we've written together. I met him working for Norman Lear. We wrote our sitcoms together. He's fantastic.
That's awesome. So do you have a run? I want to keep going with the book, but just real quick on the Netflix movie, since you brought it up. Like, do you work for what Netflix?
No, I don't have an overall deal with Netflix. Okay. No, I've made 2 movies. They've bought 3. We haven't made the 3rd one. They're a great partner.
My friend Sal D'Amelio loves holiday movies. He's like, I do a show where we talk about stuff, and he's always, we kind of make fun of him a little bit, because it's like, he's not the person you would think would just love Christmas rom-coms, but he like can't get enough of holiday rom-commy type shows. So I told him about your movie. So I made sure he's going to watch it.
Good. My boyfriend loves Christmas movies because he's guaranteed a happy ending. So I've done a few of them. They're great. It's Holiday Rush actually was inspired by Dale's daughter's notorious Christmas list.
Oh, really? That's amazing. All right, well, let's go back to the book. So that we got much more Marine story to tell. The whole time you're there, you're keeping this a secret. So you have to, it's the whole rigors of a really hard time in boot camp. I mean, it's like, they don't let up on you.
And remember, I went in with no physical training. I'd never played a sport in my life. As I said, was incredibly underweight. Never run a mile. No one had ever screamed at me like that. It was quite the awakening.
I was a skinny kid and not athletic at all. I remember being on a floor hockey team that my parents signed me up for, and it was the worst thing ever. But when I was reading...
Is that not on ice? Is that hockey on the floor?
Yeah, it's just like floor hockey. Yeah, it's like...
Not on ice.
Not on ice, no. Please, ice, I would... that would be a death sentence.
What makes the puck slide?
It's just, I don't know. It's just, it's on like one of those gym floors. So it's slick.
Was there even a puck? Was this hockey?
Was this a fever dream?
Yeah, we might need to pull this apart, Joe.
No, it's floor hockey. I don't know. It's just, yeah, it's something we did in gym class. And
yeah, I probably would air quote that from now on.
Anyway, my point was, when I was reading about you doing the physical and three pull-ups, I was like, wow, I would have been out right there. I would have been like,
everybody listening, go try to do a pull-up right now.
Pull-ups are not easy. And then, to do, three, I was like, how did you pull that off? It's just a skinny kid without any athletic background.
Oof. You know, a lot of it was because, yes, I had never done one and so couldn't imagine doing three. It probably helped that I was skinny and didn't have a lot to lift, maybe. But it was Dale. He was right there. He was in my line of sight. He slapped me on the back going up there. I know you can do it. He's a fantastic motivator.
Amazing.
I should have had Dale here. He is really funny, actually.
Dale sounds amazing. He does. He sounds like everyone needs a Dale in their life. I think that's...
It's the family quote is, it's good to be Dale.
So as you're hiding the secret, right? You're keeping the secret, right? You have to make sure nobody... Because the reality is they'll probably beat the shit out of you, right? I mean, if this is the time, right? I mean...
That's the fear I led with, actually. Not that I was going to be discovered and court-martialed and have this weird public trial. It was that the second that they found out, whoever that was going to beat the shit out of me right there.
Yeah. So that's got to be horrible. So to live with that day after day, and maybe the answer is never to this question is, were you able to just instinctively internalize the slurs, the gay slurs that your officers were throwing out where your face wouldn't react? Like you talked about, like during the interview, you had to make sure you weren't giving it away on your face. Like
it actually helped that they were thrown out so often and indiscriminately, because I realized really quickly that those weren't aimed at me. They were calling everybody faggot. So, you know, yes, I was like, think it hit more personally to me at first, but soon it was just another word. I encourage everybody to understand that when someone makes a slur at you, that's not about you. That's about them. They don't know you.
I agree with that 100%. Most people, it's amazing how many people's hate is rooted in absolutely nothing other than what is told to them, maybe by someone else who carried the hate and probably doesn't understand it either. You know, as a Jew, like with anti-Semitism, you know, personally, it's like, it's amazing what people will say or believe that they don't even know why they believe it at some point in their lives.
I hope you also understand that it sounds like you do, that that's not you, that's them.
Oh, right. It's just unbelievable because I was at a Comic-Con. I mean, this was 2 weeks ago and we're waiting in line to meet somebody and we're talking to this guy. I'm with my friend who's also Jewish. The guy makes an anti-Semitic comment and then looks at us and goes, "You're not Jews, are you?" And we're like, yeah, we are. And then in our heads, both me and we talked about it later, but we both went into the same mode. We now represent Jews. We now got to come off where he thinks, oh, these are just two normal Jewish guys. We're both at a Comic-Con. We have similar interests. We're actually meeting the same person. And, you know, oh, Jews aren't that bad. You know what I mean? You know, it's all of a sudden we were like the representative. And it's like,
but at least I'm glad that you did represent. You could have easily pulled something like from the biblical days and denied your faith or whatever, but you didn't. And I did lie and I felt awful that I was lying, because the closer I would get to people that didn't know, the worse I felt, because I knew that that was something between us. And you always live in that fear. If they do know that, are they going to still support you? And are you still going to be friends? Or is that going to fracture it? Sometimes just the secret alone might fracture it, much less the judgment for whatever that is that you're hiding.
If we flash forward for a second, have you bumped into any of those people, or do you stay in touch with any of those people who now know that you are gay and that you had hidden it at the time, you know, and what their reactions might have been? Or
no, I don't. Not from that, my boot camp platoon, the platoon in the book. A few people have found the book and reached out and loved the story. I mean, look, this is a love letter to the Marine Corps. There is no question. My book is a love letter to the Marine Corps. I hate the policy that discriminated against gays in the military, but I'm so, to use an overused word, I'm just so grateful for the things that they did give me. I got a lot more from them than they got out of me.
That's good. It's all right. The bathroom situation sounded undeniably horrible.
They got to put that on the brochure, people. It's just a nightmare. I was not a guy that would go and this communal trough thing with the urinal. Who created that? Who thinks that's a good idea? Is anybody comfortable with that?
No. When you see it at like some like big sporting places, right? Where you go to like the men's bathroom, and it's, you ever notice, you know, what's funny is when you go and any guy will use an open stall. No problem at like a public place. But if they walk into an actual stall, they always close the door behind them.
Yeah. I mean, I just don't know what it is, but that, and maybe it's to put us all on the level playing field or whatever, or it's a lot cheaper. But yeah, I was not excited about a communal trough. And then at the time, Paris Island had no stalls between the toilets. So after you walk past the urinal trough of terror, you just go into an open room of toilets, and guys are sitting there. Eventually, as we got more comfortable with each other, people are passing around letters and sharing things while they're sitting around. And I'm like, which of you people was raised in a house with more than one toilet and a bathroom where this is just totally normal and comfortable for you?
Is that part of, like, you think the Marine training, like they're trying to create this mentality amongst all of you? So if you go to war, there's no event or thing that can kind of separate you, and you're like, you become this one, all those weird things just get pushed to the side. Because of the way they treat you, and like, it's just an interesting, I don't even know how to phrase it, maybe, but like.
No, you're right. We are stripped of our individuality from day one. Our heads are shaved. We're put in the same uniforms. We're told that there's no more black, white, brown, any other skin tones in here. Everybody's green. You're dark green, light green, in the fuck between green, maybe a little pink. And you're there for a different purpose. You're not there for yourself. You're there for your brothers. You're there for your fellow Americans. And you have to remember that the military's job in that 13-week boot camp is to train you to act on an order without thinking to accomplish that mission. And that includes possibly committing the act of murder for your country. And you're born and raised not to do that or want to do that. And of course, no one wants to do that, but they do have to get you to that point where you would.
There was an interesting quote in the book, pray for peace, prepare for war. That was a pretty powerful sentence. I mean, you can apply that to a lot of things, but like, I thought that was it was really interesting. It made me stop and think for a second when I read that. So let's talk about the potential of getting you into the mindset for murder. I mean, they make your gun, it sounds like, your rifle is like, becomes a part of you, from what I gathered from the book.
Yeah, you don't even fire it for several weeks. And I hadn't fired there. I'd fired there's a story in the book about my first time firing a gun before boot camp. And you're with that rifle 24/7. You march with it, you pull it apart in, you know, you're timed how quickly you can disassemble it and reassemble it. You learn everything about it for maybe 5 or 6 weeks. Then you move off to the rifle range and spend 2 weeks at the rifle range. So it is a very precious time because all Marines are riflemen. That's our first duty. And if you can't shoot, you're not an effective Marine. And if you're not an effective Marine, why are you there?
Is the scene from Forrest Gump accurate when he's dissembling and reassembling?
I don't remember the scene. I'm so sorry.
I tell you what, Tom Hanks in the very beginning where he's got the whole body, he puts the gun together so fast.
Yes, that's how it is, very fast.
Okay.
It's a matter of seconds.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You get the Volcara group off and the air doll. Yes, it's so rapid. And you just keep doing it. I mean, look, we march and drill on the drill field. Watch some YouTube videos of Marines marching, and it's fantastic. And we polish our boots for hours and hours a day. We polish our brass belt buckle hours and hours a day. So everything that we do is perfect. We fire a lot before we even qualify. So the three levels, you can qualify as an expert, a marksman, or a sharpshooter. A sharpshooter is just an expert in every other people's world.
Wow.
Or even a marksman.
I thought the story in the book was funny about Dale being like this master. I think it was his boot, shining his boots.
Yeah. Oh.
But he had no idea why they were so great.
No, that's a really funny chapter in the book because he really had no idea, but it was incredible. And we'd all come to me as his best friend, and he couldn't say how he got his boots so shiny, but it was remarkable. Where even, as you know from the book, the our drill instructors brought an entire platoon over to visit Dale's boots and marvel at them.
So funny. Talk to me about the food. I got the impression it was like really, really bad.
It's just awful. And that's not coming from snoob, a food snob place. I think I just invented a word, a snoob. But the fact that I was skinny made them think that they needed to fatten me up, and they decided to put me on double rations. And to eat two amounts of this slop was impossible. So I made a deal with them, and you'll see how that worked out in the book. It was a smart deal on my part. But the food was made, you have to remember, it's they're on a budget, I'm sure. They've got thousands of boys to feed and young women to feed. And the eggs were reconstituted. They were like powder eggs somehow that got turned, add water, and it comes back into eggs. At the beginning, I hadn't yet figured out that this was all the food we were getting, those three meals a day. Because you're used to, maybe you don't like this, that's okay, in a couple hours I'll get a snack. No, there is no snacks. You just get those three meals. You don't have a 7-Eleven you go pop into. You don't have things stashed away in your footlocker, none of that. And so gradually, or really quickly, actually, probably after 2 days, I was eating everything on my plate because you're expending an incredible amount of energy.
Well, it sounded horrible, especially like I think there was a story about having to eat it out of the garbage. So it was just like,
yeah, you'll see that in the TV show too.
Yeah, I worked with someone whose son was in the military, and they said the grade of food that they get is not good. We need to take a quick break because I'm assuming you're hungry at this point. And we're back. Greg is about to share an exclusive story not even in the book with us.
I'll tell you a story that's not in the book. I went to officer candidate school as well, which, long story about that. But after boot camp, I was recruited to go to officer candidate school. So I'm in Quantico. And the first day we're there, there were 2 6-week sessions. First day, big speech from the commanding officer. You boys go out there and do your job well for 6 weeks, train hard, get high scores, and we're going to reward you at the end with a steak dinner. So for 6 weeks, I had that steak dinner carrot dangling in front of me, and I fired really well, not just for that, but it was a big motivator.
Sure.
And ran extra hard and fast and passed my inspections, did everything I could. Last day comes, whoever's left. I mean, there's a big attrition rate at officer candidate school because you can just leave. And I'm in the line, we're outside, and I don't smell a grill. And I'm thinking, okay, I guess maybe they're cooking them inside, bringing them out. Not sure why we're out eating outside. Getting closer. And then I can see Cookie, the chef, standing behind a huge pot, reaching into that pot with tongs, and pulling a steak out of the boiling water and throwing it on a plate. 6 weeks I'd waited for a steak, and I get the sole of a shoe.
Ah, my heart goes out to you once again.
And one of my fellow Marines was so upset and disgusted, and we were sitting outside. He saw a small frog hop by. He picked up the frog, and as a true Marine, popped it in his mouth and ate that frog instead of that steak.
Wow, okay.
You might see that in a TV show.
That's protein's protein, as they say, right? You got squirrels in the book too, so.
Yes, there was a squirrel that was eaten. Oh, not man. Live.
No. So at the end of everything, you were awarded private first class. They picked 6 people out of your.
I am just as shocked as you. Yeah, to be meritoriously promoted at the end was incredible. This is a place that was giving me things that I not only had never gotten in life before, but I didn't think that was something that was available to me. I wasn't born to be a competitor or anything like that. So to have my senior drill instructor decide that I was one of the 6 of 72 recruits to promote to the next rank was overwhelming. When I walked up to get it, I was aware that there were probably people that thought, him? Really? Because that's just how we roll.
Dale was one of the 6 as well.
Yes, and he also got honor man.
Yeah, it's like they say, you rise to the people that you're around and be with. And, you know, in the stories in the book, it's not surprising at the end of the book when you make that reveal or share that information. Because, I mean, how hard you worked with the obstacle course and everything that you did to get through. It's like, yeah, all right.
They were teaching me to want that. They were teaching me and showing me that I could. You know, when my drill instructor saw that I wasn't believing in myself, he gave me the most important advice that I could give to anybody. which is stop thinking of yourself as less than. Stop thinking of yourself as average. And there's no limits on any of it. You've got a show. Did you grow up thinking you were going to have a popular podcast and interview people on the Zoom?
No, that never did occur to me, actually. But you're right. It's all about, you know, just believing in yourself. And a lot of times people achieve things because they just believe they can. And those that don't just chose to believe it wasn't for them. They couldn't do it.
Right. And you might have struggled to, like, look, when you bought that equipment, you've got a thing you're talking into. I think that's some sort of microphone diffuser. You've got headphones. You had to go buy that. Maybe you have a camera. Were you thinking, is this worth it? Is this going to pay off? Should I do this?
It's true. It was a journey. I invested very little. And then as it started going, I put a little more into it. And I'm like, I'm in full, you know? So, you know, in podcasting, most people quit after 7 episodes. So it's, you know, it's not totally easy to do it. It's, you know, you can start. It's just like anything. It's just, there's a grind to it that once you kind of get into it, you gotta go.
You've learned just what I articulate in the book, which is when you think you can't take one more step, you actually can.
That was a great message from the book. It was interesting. I was, where they put in something like a mouse or something in water. And as it started to drown, they pulled it out and saved it. And then they put it back in the water. And once it knew that it would be saved, it was able to tread water for days, because it's just the belief that can keep you going. And like that, once you have that, and it's the absence of that that can cause you to give up. But if you have the belief and it's tangible, you can accomplish anything. Look at us.
Marine Corps drill instructors are phenomenal people. They're not going to give up on you unless you give up on yourself more than once. I gave up on myself many times. And to have these guys remotivate you is fantastic. I sound like a recruiting ad for the Marine Corps. Please go sign up and change your life. But it's certainly not for everybody. Didn't imagine that as my journey, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. And yeah, so I owe a lot to those drill instructors and even my fellow Marines that cheered me on, and I was cheering them on too. It's great. You know, I cheer for your success.
Well, thank you. I'm cheering for you too. I'm excited. And part of my cheering is that the book is becoming a TV show on Netflix. Is it becoming a TV show or a movie?
Yes, a series.
A series. Okay, awesome.
So we just finished writing season one.
Amazing. So tell me about the journey from taking the book, becoming, you know, to getting a Netflix deal, working with, you know, getting Norman Lear on board, all that kind of stuff.
I was already gone from Norman and working on another show when Norman hired a new director of development, Rachel Davidson. And I would still come into the office to work on things that they were working on, you know, kind of like a journeyman writer. I'd pump something out that they needed or whatever. And Rachel would hear Norman call me Sergeant. And she thought that it was like calling a big guy tiny or something.
Sure.
She said, it was funny. And Norman said, no, he's actually a sergeant in the Marine Corps. And she said, well, I got to hear that story. Based on how I look, I don't mind being judged on how I look. Just don't tell me I'm a bad cook. But so we started talking about it, and she started hearing these stories. And, you know, Norman was a big supporter from day one of this project as possibly a script. So when I first was working for him, I actually wrote, my first assignment for him was rewriting a movie we had in development. It was Arnold Schwarzenegger was going to play the Tooth Fairy. We ended up not making that movie. That went on to be made by other people for The Rock. But Norman's idea was, what if Schwarzenegger's day job as the Tooth Fairy was a Marine Corps drill instructor? So I did a rewrite on that and did a Marine Corps drill instructor pass. You know, so Norman always loved that story. And I tried to think of writing it as a script at that time. But this was before Will and Grace was on. There weren't a lot of gay characters on television. And so I didn't see a marketplace for it as a shoppable show or film script. So that's why I wrote it as a book. I didn't create IP on purpose. I do get that question a lot because there are screenwriters that are taking their scripts and turning them into quick books. And that's not what I did. I really wanted to learn and write this story, long form narrative. Look, I'd written scripts. I'd never written a book. That's, again, something that I wanted to do. So Rachel was really encouraging, even while I was writing the book, and would read drafts and pinpoint things that she thought I should dive deeper into. My writing partner, Sean Dwyer, did the same thing, and it was great. And then by the time I was ready to publish the book, Rachel optioned it officially. And we were careful about who we shopped it around to, because we didn't want to get a lot of no's. Because once you get a no, it's a no. It's hard to bring that project back in. And I had sent the script to Norman for notes. And I'd done a pilot adaptation of the book myself with Sean. And that's not what sold, the book sold, not our adaptation. And Norman saw it and he got it. And he's like, I want in, which was great. And he's got a producing partner named Brent Miller, who's also an EP on the show. And Brent totally got it. And they have a deal with Sony. It's a first look deal, which means, for people that might not know, you, if you have a deal, you take it to Sony. And if they like it, they develop it. If they don't want to develop it, you're free to take it somewhere else. So Norman took it to Sony. They said, yes, we went in on this. I started having some really fun meetings with Sony, and they were terrific. They wanted to make sure that the story was protected, and every step along the way, you know, that when we did find the showrunner, that it was, that he was a true partner for me. And that's come to pass. And we developed it. This was right as lockdown was happening. So the last in-person meeting I had before lockdown was with Sony. And we had had enough of those in-person meetings where we could pick up on Zoom. So for about the first 3 months of COVID, we started interviewing showrunners and found one. His name is Andy Parker. He's fantastic. And then we started developing the pilot story, and we went off to pitch. And then we pitched, I think it was March of 2021. And we got in a bidding war between Apple and Netflix. And that was fun and wild. And, you know, I'm trying to appreciate every step of this journey. So I love that Rachel optioned the book. I love that Norman got interested. I love that Sony got interested. It was just going up these great steps. And believe me, for every step up, just like what I went through in boot camp, there were 50 steps back and tons of disappointments and crushing defeats and anxieties. And then we'd get a little success. So we decided to go with Netflix. They had an interesting offer. So we started the writer's room. We started staffing the writer's room. And I was really excited because we found two combat Marine veterans to write. So we have Nick Jones and we have Megan Farrell Burke, who's an officer in the Marine Corps. So we had that perspective from her. And we also had our writer's assistant, who was an Air Force veteran. She's amazing and got to fill in those gaps because that's part of Dale's character's backstory is the Air Force, obviously, just like in real life. And we just started breathing in. So all the characters that you meet in the book that you get little glimpses of, we get to expand those and get to know them a lot better.
That's awesome. So, all right. So you have the book, right? So you have a basis of stories, right? And then what is it, like a eight episode season? That's usually...
It's 10 episodes.
10 episodes. Okay. So we've adapted The Pink Marine into 10 episodes. And I love that they're like 8 to 10 episodes like on Netflix, because you get like solid story. You don't have to, like with the 24 episode seasons, you don't, you know, like of yesteryear.
Yeah, we needed 10. It's just, you know, boot camp is 13 weeks. We didn't want to rush it. We really wanted to get to know these people. And I was very happy to get 10. Yes, you're right. There, an order could have been 6 or 8.
So when you come up with season one, do you kind of say, all right, this is what season two likely could be. This is what season three could likely be.
Yes.
And then that's part of the pitch. So if you get if they renew it, you can go right into and you have like at least the outline of where you want to go.
Yes. Typically on any show, you go in with ready to pitch the whole arc of the first season with specifics. And then you just talk about in broad strokes, what you do in the second season and the third season and the fourth season. So we went in just with that. And Andy did a great job of weaving in, you know, the new, there's obviously a ton of new characters, and some of the characters are based on other things. And some of them are just new characters that aren't in the book. So it's yes. And every character has an arc, and my character is obviously our way in and then the through line. And I can't reveal a lot, but
you've read the book. They should read the book. No, you guys want to find out what happens in the show before the show, you go read the book.
Yes. And we do, we end the first season, they are, you know, we'll see who graduates boot camp.
Did you get to pick who played you?
We haven't cast yet. We just got out of the writer's room yesterday.
Okay. All right.
I actually was, I woke up this morning thinking, wait, I don't go into the writer's room today. That's unusual. We've been in the room for 9 months. Yes. So now the holidays are coming up and we, as you know, Hollywood shuts down. So we will begin casting. We'll get some lists early December. Who's going to play me? You know, I don't know because he's 18. Do we know him?
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Okay. Oh, that's exciting. So I didn't realize, like, I don't know the entire process, how it all works. So when you said writer's room, I didn't know if, like, you know, you got the first scripts and you're shooting and you're writing that, you know, that kind of thing.
That's a way to do it. Certainly that's the normal way. You know, I've written on shows where you're shooting one episode and then down on the soundstage and we're back in the writer's room polishing the next week's episode and working on the future scripts. So now COVID gave us a chance to sometimes write all of our shows at once before we go and shoot them. There's some benefits to that. There's some hard things, you know, we might do some rewrites once we meet the actors and hear their strengths and weaknesses. Some actors are better at comedy than others and we're a dramedy. So most people have a little drama, a little comedy. We'll see what we find. I'm excited to see who we find. I'm relishing every step of this. So as sad as I was to see The Room end last night, my boyfriend and I were talking about it. I'm just still so excited that even happened. I'm going to be dining out on those stories for the rest of my life.
That's so great. I'm so happy about it. What's the timeline, do you think, of, like, what would be the normal timeline? If all goes well, it gets a good casting, when would they start shooting and when would Netflix maybe start to air it? Are we a year out?
About a year out. So what we'll do is, depending on where we shoot, if we're shooting in a warm enough climate, we can be shooting in March of 2023 and probably a 6-month shoot. And then we can be editing along the way and then get that ready for probably early 2024. That's amazing. Up to Netflix because, you know, they have a strategy on when they release things and what's popular and hopefully they'll love us and they'll think highly enough of us to give us a big launch. I don't know. I like what we've written.
I'm sure it's amazing. If the book is any indicator of the awesomeness of the TV show, then it is sure to be amazing. So I'm excited for it.
And Jeff, I definitely am aware of how fortunate I am to have lived the experience, written the book, and now get to write on the TV show. I don't take that for granted at all.
We'll talk after. We'll start to write a book about me and the podcast.
Hey, we'll get you an outline in just a couple of days.
Yeah. Is the show called The Pink Marine or just?
It is, but I don't know that you never know if they're going to change it or what. So right now in my mind, it certainly is. But if something tests better, hard to imagine something testing better than Pink Marine, but.
It's so great. I know.
And it's an ensemble show, just like the book. It's not just my story. We're telling all the stories.
That probably gives it some good legs for multiple seasons and all that kind of stuff as well. So awesome. Well, thanks for hanging out with me. This was so cool. I loved hearing all about this.
Well, thanks for your great questions. I appreciate all that. I love that you were so interested and I really appreciate your reading the book and the things that you latched onto. It sounds like you took away some of the things that I really wanted to get across.
Wow. Thank you for writing it and allowing me to do that because it's always fun to be able to dive into other people's worlds and it was great. Like I said earlier, it's reading to me has always been a little bit of a chore and I had your book sitting out. It drove my wife crazy because she doesn't like things sitting out, but I was like, no. And I would sit down and it was a great opportunity just to kind of read through every one of the chapters. Just was boom, boom, boom. It was great.
Well, shout out to my editor, Nicole Klungel. She is fantastic and was a great partner to work with because that's, again, those are skills that I didn't come in with. So I really relied on her support and her brain because pacing is an important thing. Like you just said, you know, some chapters are short. I work with young writers with the Writers Guild has a terrific program. If you're out there and you're a military veteran, please apply. The Writers Guild has a year-long mentorship program and military veterans audition or write something to get in, they're in and they work with working writers in Hollywood for a year on shaping a script and then they get to go out and pitch it. So got a terrific class I'm working with this year. It's a terrific, you get organized and just like you said, you want to turn your podcast into a book, get organized, get a beat sheet out, get an outline and Boom.
Boom.
Go. And you'll understand pace. You'll understand what, when a chapter needs to be short. Just like in a movie, there's a reason that we write scripts to pace.
Right. Exactly. All right. This has been amazing. I can't thank you enough. So enjoyable. Thank you so much.
And I thank you.
All right. How amazing was Greg Cope White? Check out his memoir, The Pink Marine. You can find it at thepinkmarine.com. All Greg goodness can be found there. His movies you can get on Netflix. And keep an eye out for The Pink Marine when it becomes a series on Netflix. How exciting is that? A little behind the scenes. Pretty cool stuff. All right, well, I'm excited. Even though I'm just realizing with the interview over, that means episode 218 has come to an end. Where does the time go? I want to thank again my amazing guest, Greg Cope White. And of course, I want to thank all of you for coming back week after week. It means the world to me, and I'll see you next time.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Classic Conversations. If you like what you heard, don't be shy and give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Also, why not go ahead and tell all your friends about the show? You strike us as the kind of person that people listen to. Thanks in advance for spreading the word, and we'll catch you next time on Classic Conversations.